Call the meeting to order of the State of Arizona Board of Podiatry Examiners, November the 9th in the year 2022, and it is now 8:32 a.m. Heather, want to go through our roll call so we make sure we have everybody present?
Dr. Foreman?
Present.
Dr. Campbell?
Present.
Dr. Ulano? We have a quorum.
Also note that our Executive Director, Heather Broaddus, our AAG, Seamus Monahan, all the investigators today are Dr. Daniel Saunders, Dr. Cameron Farahani, and Dr. Deidre Polakoff. And we have several guests that are present, that will be present for the meeting with our counsel, and some complainants will be calling in and out. So does anybody have any declaration of conflict of interest on any case that is on the agenda today? Hearing none, we'll move on. And just a reminder that this is a professional meeting, and if there's any disruption, I always reserve the right to remove people from meetings. We're going to go ahead and move on past our minutes and go directly to subheading 5, which is items for board review. We have investigation files, and we're going to go start here with complaint 22-05-C, Dr. Seth Clark, who is present in the boardroom along with his counsel, Mandy Harvis. If you would like to come up and say, Dr. Saunders is the investigator, and he is participating telephonically. So we'll ask Dr. Saunders to go ahead and please give his report.
Okay, thank you. I will try to summarize my report for you guys here. It's a little long, so. Visiting Dr. Clark, 2205CC. Yeah, completely. Initially, GH, on the patient Dr. Clark's on several different occasions, but recently she had a procedure done that had some complications, and she put a complaint in that she had given Dr. Clark permission to do some of the procedures that were performed. She was unhappy with the fact that she developed an infection, and she was not happy with the aftercare or postoperative treatment that she received. During that, I had a conversation with GH, and she just confirmed that she never agreed to have that work done. She was unhappy with the care. And she felt that some of the paperwork was dishonest and perhaps even changed at times. She's obviously unhappy. She has another procedure complication that led to an amputation. Provided a written response. He denied any wrongdoing. He points out that the informed consent was signed. And he outlined in his charts some of the pre-op notes that they discussed the surgery prior to procedures being done. And he outlines in his written response each encounter that was performed. I made some summary notes of the charts and the visits that the patients that they had. GH was initially seen 2 years prior to the procedures being encountered just for a ingrown toenail, had a nail avulsion performed in 2018, uneventful. Patient then came back 2 years later in mid-2020 that started the initial concern for them. She was evaluated there at that point by Dr. Clark, having pain to her left leg, like an empty joint. Dr. Clark evaluated her. There was, in the notes, money to have some pain to the second MPJ and having some hamstring deformities and possibly a neuroma. Conservative therapy was started on that visit. Patient underwent the injection to the second MPJ and the neuroma injection. A few months later, patient was still having some pain. A diagnostic ultrasound was then performed and another injection to that second MPJ/neuroma. There is a little bit mentioned in the report for an ultrasound for a second MPJ pathology, nothing noted for the neuroma in documentation. 2 weeks later, the patient came in with some concerns regarding an ingrown toenail again. That was addressed. And at that point, on that visit, the patient underwent procedures in the office for a nail avulsion. And then a flexor tenotomies for the hematomas of the left foot, 2 through 5. In reviewing the notes, there was a generic kind of consent form signed on that date for office-based procedures, incorporating, I guess, a vast majority of procedures that we do in the office. Patient was then followed up subsequently for 1 month afterwards, again, concerned about the ingrown toenails. There are no notes in there regarding the previous post-operative or any mention regarding the flexor tenotomies. And at this point, another now procedure was then performed bilaterally. Now biopsies were performed for both of the toes at that point. Another follow-up appointment. This is approximately 5 months from the initial encounter for the second toe pain. After the tenotomies were performed, patients in following up again with more pain to that second MP joint. Kind of a cut and paste. Chief concern mentioned that no treatments have been performed at this point, but the patient didn't have some tenotomies and multiple injections. There's no new information that I noticed that was provided. No discussion regarding previous treatments and their outcomes. And then another diagnostic ultrasound was performed to the second MPJ. Another injection was then performed. No on the second MPJ. This was under ultrasound guidance, according to the notes. Subsequent follow-up visit a month later, again, notes are kind of cut and pasted at this point. Patients having pain now to a slightly different area than the first MPJ isn't documented. Therefore, it's noted another diagnostic ultrasound has been performed. And there are some results showing moderate DJD. A therapeutic injection was then performed to the first MP joint at the time. This was, I believe, bilateral. And then this is the first mention that there is discussion regarding surgical intervention need. And I make a note of this because it's relevant to the case, but there was discussion documented that home health would be utilized for follow-up care. So the patient is brought in approximately a little more than a month again and does consent for surgery. Looking up during that visit. And then the patient's coming on a week later for a pre-op physical. Pre-operatively, nothing new is added. At that point, it's mentioned that surgical was discussed this again. So surgery was at least discussed approximately 3 times and was documented at that point. There is a surgical procedure performed 3 weeks later in January 2021. Multiple procedures are performed just to review it. A first MPJ was arthrodesis was performed with bone graft harvest. Hematoma procedures 2 through 5 again were performed. There was a midfoot tenotomy procedure times all 4 of them, and a pan med head resection. Of note on this point, looking through the dates, there's a pathology report noted that a epidermal nerve fiber density was collected on this date from doctor's office. There's no mention of this in notes anymore. Samples were done. The date of service was noted on that surgical date. There's no mention in the op note for the collection of this. That's addressed a little bit later. But there was a study performed on that date. This has been followed up for post-op visit on 2/11. This is nearly 2 weeks after the procedure. Dr. Clark's notes demonstrate some non-compliance. Home health had visited and changed bandages at this point initially prior to the patient coming into Dr. Clark's office. This is actually a well-documented note, has a unique entry. There were some appearances of some blood blisters on Dr. Clark's first follow-up. 2/18, this is a week after that visit. Documentation of weight bearing or compliance, again, is noted in the chart. There is some discussion regarding thickening of toenails. Patient is referred then for physical therapy. And then on this date, again, nail volutions were performed and sent for a biopsy. The second time that they were sent, I believe. No real documentation as to rationale for the repeat procedure, I know down here. And it's unclear if this was a a total version, a partial version, or just a punch biopsy that was performed. But it appears the pathology indicated a punch, but I think it was noted in the chart that it was an avulsion performed. Patient continues to follow postoperatively. Dr. Clark, there's continuing documentation for noncompliance. It was mentioned that home therapist has been updating Dr. Clark regarding the status of the foot, but it's not quite documented in his charts for that. We've mentioned in the chart that the patient wants to have her kidney wires removed as an outpatient. Dr. Clark acknowledges this. He has said that he'll perform it under anesthesia. And he documents that there's going to be some infection clean up at this time. Physical exam is kind of cut and paste from previous prescriptions with references of deep hardware, skin lengthening, and treatment of the foot infections. At this point, the patient is given a prescription of clindamycin. There is a procedure done as an outpatient. The operative report describes a surgical procedure to remove deep hardware. It appears to be a template note as well. There are some references to incisions that were made. Layered closure of skin. There's no mention of infection during the operative report. There's no culture insensitivity that's reported from this state. The follow-up visit after that second procedure to remove the hardware or the K-wires, it mentions that it's hardware removal on skin lengthening, but there's no commentary on infection or anything addressed at this point from that follow-up visit. There's a refill for clindamycin a few days after that procedure as well. I see some first notes here from a home health agency on 322. They've been treating some wounds for a couple of months. There's some confusion here because the initial home health agency had merged with another group and some of the original methods were unobtainable. This particular female medical group that's been now taking care of the wounds have a nurse practitioner that has been treating the wounds. They prescribed some mucosin for topical wound care, and they did a wound culture and sensitivity a week later, documented pseudomonas. The wound care nurse has been cleaning and using mucosin at this point. There's some documentation in their notes regarding some slough to the eschar formation. Small little wounds are approximately 1 by 1 centimeters. The wound care team, or the Athena Medical Group at this point, decides that the patient's a great candidate for amniograft, and they start doing some wound graft treatments to the patient's toes. And at some point, Dr. Clark decides that he's going to be doing them as well in his office. There's no real good documentation as to when he decides to take over for the wound care at this point. But there are some notes in April after the wound care started, after applying the amnio, that Dr. Clark is not going to do this in his office. And he does that a week later. So documenting that there's been some wound debridement and an injection of amnio into the wound care. 2 weeks after the culture for pseudomonas was noted, there's a prescription for Bactrim. The patient was previously on clindamycin. So the third prescription for Bactrim, this is on 413 after the culture revealed, or was divided on 329. Dr. Clark's notes, I believe it's the first time that in his actual notes that he mentions the actual wounds. He describes a 3 by 2 centimeter ulceration to the top of the foot thickness. He reports now at this time that there's a change from previous reporting that protective sensory is now absent. Previous physical examinations have said the neurovascular has been intact. At this point, and we performed a nerve density testing at that point. What it has on there, I have noted that some of the counters postoperatively were signed off at a later date. The notes from the 4-8 where he does the amnio injection, the notes from 4-13 where he prescribes and treats a wound, Resolution 420, 2021. This is after an admission to the hospital where the patient was admitted a day or two prior on 419 to the hospital for subsequent care for regarding an infection to the foot. And Dr. Clark had signed off on his entries on 420 after that. There is a notation that he has communicated with the hospital with infection at the hospital that is actually entered before he signs off on the notes that were not signed. I have some just general summaries and observations as well. There are two different pathology nail biopsies that were performed on these hallux nails and subsequent changes. There were two different nerve density tests that were performed within a month or two of each other. There are no initial notes from the home health regarding the initial dressing changes and appearance of the wounds. I did have a conversation with Dr. Clark, you know, as well. In general, he makes some remarks that the nail biopsies were driven by the patient regarding their care. Nerve density testing vessels or duplicates were due to patient complaining of knee numbness and tingling. However, this is not really well documented in the medical record. The nail biopsies also were done due to treatment of low treatment to see how it was responding. There are pictures that the patient submitted with her complaint. They do show, you know, post-operative eschar formations throughout the procedures. There's no gross signs of the cellulitis that I can see. There's no real ominous findings. The second digit does present with some necrosis to the tip of the toe. At one point, it's difficult to determine as to the date of the pictures if they're not marked during the postoperative course. But none of them are showing any signs of a raging infection. Further communication with Dr. Clark, he confirms that as part of his practice postoperatively, he incorporates a home health agency to see the patient and to perform some dressing changes. He does this routinely, and he can speak for himself, but he does this routinely, and the patient normally sees the home health agency before they see him for follow-up. He is uncertain as to why the notes haven't made it to the EMR. And that's, we discussed here that there was a transition of care from one agency to another, and the notes just were unavailable. He also uses the home health agency oftentimes for wound care in his offices. We discussed some of the medical record. He has no documentation for ultrasounds or injections or pictures, and we don't certain or unaware that that need to be part of the record. He normally does not record or copy the ultrasound pictures or the injection. He does multiple ultrasounds as part of his diagnostic tools. Again, we discussed the repeatable and he said it was patient-driven. It's just not well documented in those charts. There was a clarification of that second procedure, as it appeared to be just, you know, removal of some fluff and removing the KRs from the patient's foot, but he seemed to believe, to translate through his memory, that he had to make an incision to remove buried KRs. And were removed there as the pins maybe got purchased underneath the skin. There's no x-rays to demonstrate this. I could not confirm that at that point. He confirms that he did not do a culture insensitivity during that procedure as he believed that the wound care center had just done. I could not find a record of that. We had a little discussion also regarding the flexor tenotomies initially as to rationale, as to why they were done for the type of hematoma that this patient was performed. We had a discussion regarding flexor stimulation versus extensor substitution. He believed that it was a more complex type of hematoma and that this would help the patient. He does admit that there was some omission to his medical notes. That's a good explanation. And the delay in signing that we discussed was primarily due to his EMR, and it was just sitting in his inbox and being unaware. He did not feel that there was infection or a contraindication when he was going to have the annual procedures being performed when he was treating the wounds initially. I did review some of the financial reports. Billing is all in sync. The procedure was performed multiple diagnostic procedures were sent to this pathology lab as well, as we discussed. Reviewing this in summary, I know it's long-winded, I apologize. I do believe that consent was provided by the patient for these procedures. It is documented in the record. There is a generic procedural consent form that the patient did sign that covers the avulsions, the non-avulsions of those office-based flexor tenotomy procedures. They may not go into great detail regarding the office-based procedures on that signing. The patient did sign consent for the surgical procedures to be performed on all the digits. In summary, the medical records are very difficult to review. A lot of cut and paste, and the organization was hard. It's really hard for me as a physician or any other physician to kind of just step in and assume care for this patient as records are omitted somewhere at the wound center. Multiple physicians are taking care of the same problem. It's very hard to follow. I have some concern here as there's often repeat procedures being done with poor documentation as to the rationale. I worry about over-utilization is having multiple diagnostic ultrasounds, multiple nail avulsions and biopsies performed that were performed at the same unit, endoscopic nerve densities a month or two apart to expect a different outcome, especially when they were normal. And there is some concern as far as multiple procedures being performed when the doctor has his own lab as a pathology that collects revenue for that. It's unclear at this point if the patient ever did have a regulated infection. There was a culture that did come back pseudomonas. It's unknown if this is a colonization or if this was actually causing a systemic type of reaction. The patient was on antibiotics at three different times. Granted, the bacterium was 2 weeks after the pseudomonas. The wound care pictures did not look terribly ominous, as I repeated in that sense. So the patient, from my understanding, went on to a hospitalization and was taken over care by another doctor, did undergo a amputation for the digit. And then I think the patient is present can discuss a little bit more of that. And that's my wrap-up for you guys.
Thank you, Dr. Saunders. That was very complete and much appreciated. And I would agree with all your assessments. I do have a question. Was there any evidence of any kind of conservative care in the course of this patient's being with Dr. Clark?
I think initially the patient was seen for some conservative care, including some injections and such like that. Initially for the hematoid deformity procedures, the patient had two injections for a second MP joint and a potential neuroma. Patient did undergo an injection to the first MP joint as well. I don't think I mentioned this. Clinically, radiographs preoperatively do show some pathology. There was significant hematoid deformities. The MP joints were subluxated. The first MP joint did have some disease to it. So there's definitely some pathology there preoperatively.
And I didn't see any kind of examination regarding any kind of biomechanics or use of a neuroorthotic. And then back to the ultrasounds and the injections, description of anything about possible plantar plate tear to the second, or you said there was no, if I were correct, there was no description regarding the neuroma?
Correct. I believe Dr. Clark does mention, in one of his first initial ultrasounds that there was some second MPJ pathology, and it was omitted that there was a neuroma. And probably there's no discussion regarding a neuroma, and apparently the patient didn't have a neuroma. There was no neuroma surgery that was performed either. The biomechanics is the physical examination does not mention much. It did discuss hematoid deformities. It did discuss some pain locally. A lot of the notes were cut-pasted. It was definitely an extensor substitution hematose with some skin contracture. But no, I don't believe orthotics were done.
And as far as the preoperative evaluation, I believe that chart indicates, and maybe in some discussion you had with Dr. Clark, that the primary care physician didn't feel the patient needed a pre-op because they'd been seen in the office and they had no cardiac issues?
You know, I don't remember off the top of my head. I know Dr. Clark did a little bit of a pre-op evaluation. As far as like a medical clearance go, I don't think it was performed. It was necessary for the surgery center. I don't think one was done, and we can ask Dr. Clark, but I don't think so. I didn't see documentation of one being done.
So in your opinion, in a patient like this, it's obviously high risk. They've been on prednisone a long time. I believe they are on methotrexate. I think people are not evaluating their patients well medically before. You know, we're all saying, okay, you're all, right along with the MDs. Well, then if you've got to evaluate your patient because the foot's attached to that body, it doesn't come in by itself to be fixed and then come back. So my concern here is with long use of steroids, people develop steroid-induced diabetes. So you can just do a basic glucose and an H&H, just to have something, because that obviously can follow on down the line with the postoperative course here.
Yeah, I believe the patient was 72 at the time of surgery as well. So in most centers will require a little bit of a workup, EKG and such, and quite often I don't remember if one was done. And I'm going through notes now, and I actually don't see one. But it is considered, the requirements of the facilities and anesthesia, they want a pre-op evaluation. The history of systemic illness was on the steroids and stuff for a long time, so healing is always going to be slightly compromised. And that's a contributing factor as well. To go back for a surgical for a pre-op clearance before the surgery.
Thanks. Dr.
Yes, I have a question. Is there any documentation on why a second epidermal nerve fiber density test was performed?
There's no real documentation for the first one. There's no good documentation for the second, except obviously there's a change in documentation from neurovascular intact to a change that the patient has seen some sensory changes. I believe this was a few months after the procedure. And Dr. Kaufman said we just had a lack of documentation from the first one being done.
And based upon the long use of steroids, would you have staged this procedure?
Honestly, I don't think I would have staged it. I'm okay with the first MPG fusion and pen met all as one procedure that he had done. I can do it pretty quickly, so my anesthesia time is low. But I don't think it necessarily needs to be staged.
All right, thank you.
Dr. Lano, do you have any questions for Dr. Saunders?
Sure. Good morning, Dr. Saunders. This is Dr. Lano. In recognition of the delays and the did you see any of that on the x-rays that came right out of the bone that the skin is made for?
I recall correctly, he did not actually bill for the hardware removal. And I'm pretty sure Dr. Clark even mentioned that in his response, I didn't mention it, but he did not bill for hardware removal. However, I believe that the patient just went for KY removals, Dr. Clark seemed to recall, and this was a few months prior, that he had a buried wire. I did not see that on X-ray anywhere. And on the one X-ray that I saw that had wires in it, it looked appropriate. They were percutaneous. That does come into relevance if we did have to make an incision on the second toe again, and take a buried KY, and it's just a second time to compromise the neurovascular status of that toe. But, there's no documentation of an abdominal formation upon removal of the KRs. I don't believe he billed for the KRs.
The multiple lung biopsies of that epidermal nerve density test, which is screened for all the tests you perform?
So, yes. The lab has its own billing. It's under his tax ID, and he gets paid for it as an independent lab. And they pay.
Okay.
For each biopsy, it's a significant figure. I don't have it in front of me, but each one, he got paid for the procedure as a CPT code for himself, and then the office gets paid as the laboratory for the evaluations and diagnostic reports of the outcome of each nail biopsy as each nerve density examination for the stains and such that they do for it.
Okay, in relation to the amniotic injection, in what kind of usual is a contraindication for an amniotic injection for locus infection?
Yeah, I believe it's a contraindication. If there's infection in there, it's not approved, it's not going to work. And actually, there's some literature that shows that it can make it worse, and there's some that can say it makes it better, but it's generalized contraindicated to do with infection. And that's why that was Dr. Clark, and he did not feel that the foot was infected at that point enough to contraindicate doing the amnio.
I believe the
patient was on clindamycin twice and then switched over to Bactrim. I believe the timing of that was still during the procedure of that amnio. And that was done, the amnio was initially done by a nurse practitioner as part of this Athena group, and then under Dr. Clark's guidance, I believe, I'm not sure who is the captain of the ship of that, it may be the nurse practitioner practicing on her own, and then also by Dr. Clark doing one in his office.
Okay, so that means I believe that the amniotic is described for an infection that they got.
Well, in my practice, doing a prophylactic antibiotic at one time is reasonable. If you continue and refill the antibiotic, it's to treat the infection. You don't continue refilling it prophylactically. So the patient has some sort of infection being treated on clindamycin called endospectrum.
Okay. Thank you.
Mark, do you have anything, Dr. Foreman? Do you have any other questions?
No, I have no other questions.
GH is not present, so we will not obviously be hearing from her. So now I would ask Dr. Clark or his counsel if she has any comments, and then for Dr. Clark to present a summary of his care of the patient.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board. Attorney Mandy Carvis of Wicker Smith appearing on behalf of and with Dr. Clark. I'll just hit some high points, and then Dr. Clark will be happy to address any specific questions that the members of the board may have. And thank you to Dr. Saunders for his thorough and complete review of things. I think it's while the plaintiff or the patient claimed that there wasn't consent for the procedures, it's clearly documented there was pre-op consent in the office and then the day of the procedure. So I think the consent is a non-issue. With respect to post-operative issues, I think it's important for the board to be mindful of the fact of the extensive non-compliance of the patient. She wouldn't wear the boot. She wouldn't agree to be non-weight-bearing. She canceled appointments. She didn't timely show up. She was supposed to come back within days. She would come back in weeks. There was a lot of self-directed care that continued with home health and in the hospital. So those issues are well documented within home health and at Banner Boswell. The nurses calling, indicating to Dr. Clark. At one point, someone from Banner Boswell called and left a message saying, "What's going on here? It seems like she's playing games with everyone here," was being dishonest about why she was presenting to the hospital. So a lot of patient noncompliance, which obviously patient compliance, especially in the post-operative period, is critical and can impact things. That is why the pins ultimately had to be removed at the surgery center. The patient had a lot of issues because of of her noncompliance and just did not feel comfortable with doing that in the office, which is why that was ultimately done at a center. But again, that was not billed for, but that was done for patient comfort. She indicated she did not feel comfortable with that being an office-based procedure. With respect to comments about cut and paste in the EMR, I would be shocked if there isn't a physician using EMR that isn't at least cut and pasting to a certain degree. That's just a byproduct of EMR, and there's nothing inappropriate with that as long as the information is accurate. Similar with signing of records and notes and the timing, the notes are contemporaneously entered and later reviewed and officially signed, also completely appropriate. With respect to the comments about it being difficult for another provider to pick up these records and continue the care, we know that, in fact, another provider, Dr. Esbar, was actually able to do that. Dr. Esbar assumed care. There was obviously documented good communication and coordination of care with Dr. Clark and Dr. Esbar. So while it may have been somewhat difficult for Dr. Saunders to follow, there was obviously a way for another provider to assume care and follow up. With respect to Dr. Clark's communication with Dr. Esper and the hospital and the timing of signing of his notes, his communication with the hospital was obviously documented in the hospital records as well, so that was clearly there. Again, patient noncompliance played a huge factor here, not being willing to use the boot, not being willing to be non-weight-bearing, putting her own creams and things on the foot, returning for care at her schedule as opposed to what was there, continued noncompliance with home health and at the hospital. One thing that the board may not be aware of that I think is important is that we believe that there's kind of a use of the board proceeding for the purposes of furthering potential litigation. GH had retained counsel. We received letters from counsel about a possible lawsuit. Then, for reasons that I'm not completely clear, her attorney dismissed her as a client. We believe that there was a suggestion of go to the board and see what the board does and maybe come back. But since that time, and I coordinated with providing records to her counsel, GH has then called Dr. Clark's office many, many times, called me, emailed, demanding records despite the fact that they were already provided. She continues to call and harass Dr. Clark's office to this day. So there are a lot of ongoing issues here that we believe may potentially lead to some sort of malpractice action. That being said, we believe that the care here was completely appropriate and reasonable. With respect to the clinical rationale for the various procedures that the board had questions about and things with the pathology, Dr. Clark is happy to address that. There's nothing inappropriate, as we've addressed with this board before, regarding his own pathology lab. He's happy to address those questions about the nerve procedures and the avulsions directly, and I think that's probably more appropriate since that's clinical in nature. So I'll let him address that briefly, and then he's happy to answer your questions, but we appreciate the opportunity to be heard this morning.
Thank you, Mandy. She did a great job addressing a lot of the comments that the investigator had. I'd like to just take a few minutes to kind of address the questions that you had for the investigator that I think can be clarified. Dr. Campbell had just some questions about orthotics. So this is a patient who had severe rheumatoid arthritis for many years, a very deformed foot. It was recommended in every preoperative visit to try orthotics, Superfeet, Powerstep, various brands. They were recommended. Links were provided where they could obtain those types of inserts. At the time, I was still working for the arthritis group, and I wasn't allowed to carry those over the counter to just give or dispense through the office. So the orthotics definitely were a part of her treatment plan. She opted to not do custom, which is every patient's prerogative, but they certainly were part of that preoperative plan. In regards to any concerns about preoperative clearance, patient was actively, and I believe she likely is still actively followed by a rheumatologist, which she was at the time. And there were, I mean, they draw labs usually typically every 3 to 6 months. So she had very recent labs that had been drawn. It wasn't, you know, as if this patient was just, you know, blindly taken to an operating room. There were multiple labs drawn that I could follow through the course of her treatment with rheumatology. She did not have cardiac history that was indicated for an EKG. And both of the surgery centers have medical directors that review the cases as well. And if they feel that any more, not invasive, but any more thorough workup needed to be done, they would let me know. So it wasn't just my call to take her to an operating room. There were multiple rheumatologists involved with their care, as well as the medical directors at the surgery centers who also reviewed her case and deemed that her preoperative workup was sufficient. Concerning, you know, biomechanical exam, in the preoperative note, it actually is noted that there was a gait analysis performed that showed extensor substitution, which was certainly justification for some of the tenotomies prior to surgery, as well as the extensor tenotomies intraoperatively. So there was more of a biomechanical exam than initially meets the eye if you kind of dig into those notes. I would like to address the biopsies here for a moment. So I'll start with the nerve biopsy. So the first nerve biopsy was performed at the preoperative visit. They came back normal, showing she had a normal nerve density. The ENFD, that it is incorrectly put in the investigator's notes, it's epidermal nerve fiber density. It's not endoscopic. It's epidermal nerve fiber density. And what it does is it understands the density of the nerves from a small fiber basis to evaluate small fiber neuropathy. One of the most common causes after surgery of complaint is numbness, tingling that persists for months to years. As you know, the doctors, as you all as surgeons, that's one of the most common complaints. With this patient's history of prednisone use and rheumatoid arthritis, I felt it prudent to get a nerve biopsy prior to surgery to be able to have a baseline. So that way, if she had numbness, tingling, nerve pain, or you know, neuropathy sensations after surgery, that I would have a baseline to be able to go off of, which ended up being exactly what happened. She ended up with some interesting nerve symptoms after surgery. Her physical exam status changed, and so a repeat ENFD was performed to assess the difference between preoperatively and postoperatively. Similar with the nail biopsies, one had been done months prior that showed a onychomycosis, and it showed and identified which fungus was present. Most patients elect to do some kind of topical antifungal. In her case, it was Lotrimin, and it is perfectly appropriate. It was at least 6 months later, I believe, to repeat a nail biopsy to see the progress, to see if it's gone, to see if she needs to switch medications. The repeat nature of these procedures and these biopsies would be the same as getting a repeated X-ray or a repeated ultrasound, or if you know if someone has an infection, you're monitoring to get a repeated culture, or you know, if someone comes in with high uric acid, they start allopurinol, doesn't do a lot of good to start them on that if you're not doing a repeat lab to test to see how effective it is. And so the repeat nature of these isn't arbitrary. There was definitely a rhyme and a reason. Patient had either been treated, in the example of the nails, was being actively treated for it, and therefore progress needed to be monitored, or in the situation for the nerve density, it was repeated because there was a change in neurologic status on physical exam and on her subjective exam. So those were very, you know, medically necessary. Aside from just being justifiable, they were very medically necessary given the treatment course that she had been going through. Yeah, for that second surgery, I would just like to reiterate what Dr. Saunders said, that yes, that second surgery to remove the pins, I did not bill for that. I did not feel that removing them would necessarily justify a deep hardware removal, and I just felt that her insurance shouldn't have to pay for that repeat procedure anyway. However, as noted in the operative note, the pins had been buried due to her non-compliance. You know, when she refuses to wear boots, she comes in a shoe, she's pushed those pins so far in, incisions had to be made on the tips of the toes, they had to be dissected down, K-wires had to be removed, and at that point, if they're buried under the skin, I mean, it's a deep removal for the fact that they're buried under the skin, and the K-wires, because it was a pan-met head resection, they were buried all the way into the metatarsals, and I believe one of them even into the midfoot to allow enough stabilization of those toes. But again, it wasn't billed from my end. I wasn't taking her to an operating room to make a paycheck on a deep hardware removal. It was clearly indicated and needed, and she just frankly wouldn't let me remove them in the office. She wanted to have some sedation for that, which I felt was reasonable given that her non-compliance had led to buried K-wires. And then just lastly about the amnio issue. As had been noted, the wound care doctors had started wound grafting. So they used, I believe it was, they'd say the products, and their goal was to use amniotic wound grafts, like the amniotic membranes. And at the time, the amnio fluid that we used was indicated where you would give one of those prior to starting membrane grafts. And so the wound care team actually requested, said, hey, they actually had called me, said, hey, Dr. Clark, do you do the injectables? We would like one done prior to starting the amnio grafts. I don't believe that there was an infection that would have contraindicated this type of injection. As noted by the investigator, the pictures that he had seen, it never showed an ominous infection. She was on antibiotics, so had there been a little bit of an infection, it would have been under control and the bioburden would have been low enough that an amniotic fluid injection was certainly reasonable. And aside from being reasonable, it was recommended and requested by the wound care team. I believe that kind of sums up some of the questions that the board members had. I think Mandy did a great job of kind of addressing any of the questions that the investigator may have had. I would just like to reiterate that, this was a complicated case. I mean, it was a pan-med resection with first MPJ fusion. It was a fairly large reconstruction. She clearly was consented multiple times, not just in my office where we actually drew diagrams that show pins in all of the toes, but obviously at the surgery center level there was a second consent form there for each of the procedures. I believe she was very well consented. I believe she understood what was happening, and just unfortunately due to her non-compliance and dishonesty with her healthcare providers, it was very hard to get her to a spot where we could be happy with the outcome. Fortunately, Dr. Esper was able to take over. He was able to, read through my notes, understand what was happening, follow the flow, and assume her care, and I believe he's done a great job with her. So I believe that this hopefully addresses a lot of the questions you had, but I'd be happy to, of course, answer any more that may arise.
So, Dr. Clark, when you use, sending patients to wound centers and having home health, don't you feel it's your responsibility to follow up with them? And, you said about having issues that with their system and you're not getting their EMRs and stuff, because you're risking losing control of your patient if you don't know what's going on. So I'm just really curious if you have a set protocol that you do when you've sent somebody to home health or to the wound center, that you know exactly what's going on, that you get a report, a weekly report, or what happens.
I feel that to term it losing control would be not maybe the best way to say it. I don't specialize in wound care. And so my wound care, when wounds happen, they go to wound centers. If they have an insurance that will allow home wound care, I let them take over the wound care. It's not a matter of losing control. It's a matter of giving to the experts what they're an expert at. And there certainly is follow-up. With that particular home health company, and again, they were in the process of selling to a different company or whatever, they frequently would just give me a phone call. They would just phone call and say, hey, Dr. Clark, here's what's happening. She has this wound now. We want to start this grafting. And so it was more of a, it was a lot less paper trail at the time. And again, it was due to them selling to a different company and they weren't faxing notes. But they were calling me and we were having discussions on the phone that was helping me stay in the loop and helping me coordinate my care with them. But ultimately, the wound care was passed off to a wound care expert since they are the expert.
So I guess I should have said better communication. So do you document those telephone conversations and put them in the chart? Because you can't obviously remember everything about every patient without some kind of documentation.
That's correct. And some of the conversations are documented in the chart. I try a lot harder to make sure they're all documented. In this situation, it was documented in the chart a few times with the director of nursing at that home facility just about her concerns with the patient's patient's compliance and her concerns with her level of honesty with all of her providers. She was the one who felt that she was kind of playing everybody, and so yes, some of it is documented, and it is a point I have tried to make to document further. And I do have protocols in place now where our assistants, when someone is on a home health service, they call the service once a week to make sure that we're receiving notes. So we actually have paper notes, not just phone calls.
Yeah, so you eloquently described why you did those extra procedures. That has to be in the notes, okay, because it is not documented, and I don't know why you did those, but you have to put that in there, your rationale behind the second document, second biopsy.
Okay.
That was my one.
Dr. Alano.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Cook. I have some questions for you.
I had a really hard time understanding what he asked.
Yeah, it's hard.
Like, on a baseline for the pre-op introduction.
That's a good question. I don't do it on every pre-surgery patient. I do on patients that I feel would be at a high risk. So whether it's due to age, history of significant prednisone use, history of neuropathy symptoms in the past. So not on every single patient. If I have a healthy 25-year-old, I don't feel that there would be a need for it. But certainly on anyone who's, you know, over 55 or so, or has had neuropathy symptoms, or has been on long-term prednisone, I routinely would do a preoperative ENFD to have a baseline for, you know, for if they end up having nerve symptoms after.
And let's say we do have a postoperative, how do you treat it?
If you have a post-op what, I'm sorry?
If a patient has the positive nerve density problems, how do you treat it?
So with the ENFD test for small fiber neuropathy, and so if they're having small fiber nerve disease, there's a few options. We typically would try Metanex or an equivalent type medication that actually has been shown to somewhat increase nerve density back to normal. A lot of times, depending on the exact symptoms, I would probably even refer them to either neurology to do a nerve conduction or to pain management, because a decrease in your ENFD can actually be an early sign of RSD or CRPS. And so I use that as a very serious screening tool. That way, if it is low after surgery, I can initiate treatment myself, whether it's with medications or at least get them to a specialist to help prevent long-term nerve problems after surgery.
Okay. Now, what percentage of the patients do this?
The percentage of patients that get the baseline ENFD prior to that?
Baseline or pre-op.
Baseline, what percentage of patients do you do that on for baseline purposes?
Well, since COVID has happened, my surgical volume has decreased quite significantly. Probably maybe a fourth to half would be either in a demographic of age or risk category where I would probably do it. So probably a fourth to half.
25 to 50%.
I believe, yeah, that would be right about, yeah, that would be somewhere in there probably. So I would only do a post if they're having those neurologic symptoms. Or if they had a preoperative that was showing low nerve density, I would initiate treatment and then probably test down the road to assess that treatment, again, similar to blood labs and anything else that you would repeat a lab for.
And then let's go to the neural cultures or biopsies. You did one month after the previous one was performed.
Right.
And the frequency of the
Yeah, so, you know, those it's really, those are a little more guided by when the patient either wants to be done with whatever course of treatment it is, or when the treatment course is done. So if someone's going on like oral Lamisil, I would typically test after the course of the oral. When it's topicals, you know, I tell patients to expect months, and, you know, as they have been using the topicals for long enough, I say, hey, it's either been 6 months or a year, or when they say, hey, doc, I've been using this for a few months, I want to see if it's gotten any better, so I know if and when I can either decrease the frequency or stop, that usually is when I would do a repeat to see tick progress and see if fungus is either gone or potentially getting any better. Yeah, so it's possible that it could have been about a month. And in her situation, because nail avulsions had been performed, it's likely that if I had done one month, then when the repeat is performed, because the patient is saying, hey, I've been using this diligently, I want to stop using it, will you recheck? And you know, if they want to recheck it and it's been, you know, over a month at least, and they've been using that medication, then yes, it would get rechecked to see when they can safely come off of it.
Okay, in this particular case, the patient wanted to have a second biopsy, or second...
Correct, yeah. Yes, and even if, like, when someone's done with one, even if it's time to do a second one, if they don't want to do it, I never send it unless they actually request it. And so, yes, she requested for it to be done and asked that it be performed to be able to assess any change.
Okay. I understand on the lab, are you 100% owner, or what percentage owner of the lab?
Well, the lab is under the same tax ID as our podiatry practice, so I'm only percent owner as I am in the practice. It's we're a partnership now. I don't own the practice in total.
Thank you. At this time, I am going to make a motion to go into executive session for the purpose of receiving legal advice.
Seconded.
We'll take a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved.
Dr. Ulano, if you could disconnect on the call and call the executive session line. And for the other participants on the phone, you can stay on this call. I'm going to disconnect, so if for any reason you get disconnected, you could just call back in a few minutes.
Yeah,
evidence that it was known. So, I don't think it will. If I were to have your cell, I mean, when I was in Greece, I probably would have texted you a picture of my foot because I'm pretty sure I broke my toe when I was in Greece. And I was like, I don't know if I should like go to the Greek hospital to do anything about this or not.
No drops in your stomach?
No, I stubbed it. We were on a sailboat and I was walking barefoot, obviously trying to get from one side of the boat to the other, and I kicked one of the metal pieces and they wrapped the. Obviously, I was like, the captain saw me do it because it was private, so it was my captain and his daughter. And she goes, are you okay? Let me see your foot. Are you bleeding? I'm like, I'm not bleeding. He's like, let me see. I'm like, I'm not bleeding. He's like, do you want anything? I was like, yes, wine.
Wine. That will do the trick.
But yeah, it was like, by the time we got back, like, I was fine on the boat. And like, we swam with the hot springs and everything. And by the time we got back and I had to get off the boat, I was like, oh yeah, that way. Yeah. And like, the next day, it was like, all down my foot. It was, yeah. But they had a like a cryo tub in our at our at the spa at our hotel, so I went down there like every day. It was just like jamming my foot in there as long as I could. But I was like,
and I'm glad it's doing better for you.
Yeah.
A lot of times, like, people, best case normally is they at least lose the animal. But if that didn't even happen, that's good.
Yeah, that was like right after.
Oh.
And I got both of them. And then the next, like, it just kept getting.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, oh.
And then, is it still hurting at all, or is it most of it?
So then, like, it moved. Like, okay. I kicked it hard.
Yeah, you did. And it was fortunate, so it wasn't hurting further back. But like,
no, but then look, it like the bruise just kept moving. It was the weirdest thing. But yeah, it's fine now. It was just like we were in Santorini still when I did that, and it's just like some like walk everywhere kind of city.
Oh, yeah.
So then I was like
walking around.
Yeah,
around.
I was like, oh.
Yeah, with toes especially, if it's one of the worst toes.
Yeah.
Maybe do it like spot. Like the best thing is
like
buddy
a buddy tape.
Tape.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you buddy tape it to the, yeah. I actually had broke my pinky toe a couple years ago. And yeah, buddy taped it for a few months and it was sore for almost like a year.
Yeah.
It was sore for
every, I can tell every now and again because I go to Orange Theory like 5 days a week and I get all the time. But it's like a really heavy tread day. Like then like, it'll button me a little bit, but thankfully it was all good.
Yeah, boats do a lot, actually.
Yeah,
the best things about Greece, though, is probably
Greece.
Oh, my God. Had you been there before?
No, we hadn't. Yeah, it was our first time. And we were supposed to go. This was supposed to be our anniversary trip in 2012. Obviously, we all know what happened then. So,
right.
And then we didn't go last May because it was our. Things were obviously still a little closed last year. Mm-hmm. And then we were also doing our 25th anniversary party that May. So we're like a little. A little much. So we went this year, and like the week before we went in like mid-May, and the week before we went, they got rid of the mask mandate for planes, and they got rid of the mask mandate in Greece and the vaccination and everything.
Oh,
so the
timing
ended up being
perfect.
So yeah, we were gone 10 days. We did 2 days in Athens, 5 days in Santorini, 3 days in Mykonos, and then we just did a day in New York on the way there and on the way back. That way we didn't have like too crazy. Stuff. That was the first. After the fact, it's almost embarrassing to admit that it's the first time in my 20 years of practice that I've taken 2 weeks straight on to work. So my husband's like, "See, look, you were fine. Nobody died. The office was still standing." I was like, "Yeah, I know, but it's beautiful.
It's on our bucket list for sure.
I would highly recommend it.
I almost feel like you're going to gotta do 2 weeks.
Yeah, because like, it's 10 hours from New York. Like, the flight is long. Like, you pass over pretty much everything else to get there.
So does it go from New York to Greece?
It's direct to Athens.
Greece,
so. Yeah.
I mean,
myself really concerned, but
that was a lot.
These are all same string. So this, like the sunsets.
Oh, yeah, it's gorgeous. Oh, fun. And was the food everything?
Oh, the food was amazing. Like,
I would go with my wife more just for the food. She's a foodie, and yeah, so she, I think she would love the food.
Her food was great, like, and it was so cheap. Like, this was like $50. Mykonos is very expensive. Santorini, really, you know, reasonable. There's good wine tasting over there, so we did like some wine tasting stuff. We did this private dining thing this one night that was just really, so it was just us up here by ourselves at this decoration. Like a multi-course wine dinner. And that is a mirror. Like, that's not a picture. It was that they did like really cool presentations and all the food. One of my husband's brothers is a chef, so we were like sending him pictures of all of the courses and everything. He was very thoughtful. Some of the wineries are like pretty rustic, okay. And some of them are like Napa.
Like boozy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, very bougie. But if you want bougie, then.
All right, you can ask us about it.
All righty. You ready, Heather? Okay, we'll be. Oh, you got to call me there. Okay.
This is Heather Bettis in the board office. Dr. Yolano, have you joined the call?
Okay, so we'll be back in session at 9:38 a.m. All righty, so I have a few questions for you, Dr. Clark. You've had documentation issues in the past, and you've been through some reviews and other non-disciplinary actions. What have you learned from those courses that we had to take on documentation?
During those courses, just the importance of documenting kind of mostly the rationale. You know, the physical exam, it's usually there. So really just kind of document the rationale for doing things. I would just mention briefly, and I failed to mention this earlier, I apologize, that a lot of this patient's treatment was from my prior days working with the arthritis company and when I had their EMR. And so a lot of the documentation is from that era and has obviously since been improved upon. Just the importance of documenting the rationale, which surgical rationale, I believe, was very well documented. The biopsies, that was a relatively new thing that we had started up, so we have since developed protocols for, we have 8 doctors in the group now, so we've since developed better documentation protocols for those types of things. So I believe that concern has already been addressed within our group prior to today, but that's what I've kind of learned from it.
Well, the board is concerned that the same issues are happening again. And, we have issues with AARA, so, documentation with them, that's not on the plate anymore. This is your documentation in your new group that you're in. And maybe, Dr. Saunders said he had trouble following your note. I felt a little, it was off to me too. And I review medical records, I do IMR reviews, I grade students in national board exams, so what I see is not where it should be. And that's what I don't understand is why we're seeing a repeat. And the comment about not being aware that you needed to have information in the chart about the ultrasounds and the injections, it's just very, very basic. You know, there's no problem with your consents. You did those. The care that you gave the patient who was non-compliant, you know, you do everything, you do what you should do, but you're not documenting it. And that's the problem. And I think another physician would have troubles reading these notes. Maybe Dr. Esper, that was nice, he could pick up and move on, but I think a majority of clinicians wouldn't be able to follow the chart. So with, do you have anything else to say? Do you want to make any remarks?
No,
okay. So I'm making a motion here that we're going to offer you a consent agreement, and we'll give you 60 days to respond to that. Your counsel may offer alternative options and work with our Assistant Attorney General Seamus Monahan on that agreement. And then that agreement will come back to the board for a vote. And if that is not received, then this would move to informal hearing. That's my motion. Do I have a second? Thank you. And we have to take a roll call vote on that. So Heather, if you would do roll call vote.
Dr. Campbell?
Here.
Yay. Dr. Foreman?
Aye.
Dr. Ulano?
Aye.
Motion passes.
So moved. So we will be in contact.
May I inquire as to the terms of the consent agreement? Have you determined that yet?
Oh, I apologize. I apologize. Yes.
I think.
Okay.
Just to show it ongoing.
With the year of probation.
Okay, I just.
We can start there.
Okay. Well, I was just curious as to terms.
I'm sorry, that was that I had left that out. I apologize. All right.
Thank you. Yeah. I'll wait here for you later.
All right, so. Let's see. What I had planned to do next, yeah, where did I go to? We have, the next case we're going to take is number 22-06-C, which is Dr. April Glessinger. Counsel present is Mr. Crawford, and Dr. Farhani is our investigator. So, and I do believe we have the complainant on the line again. Initials JP. Is she still present, Heather?
Madam Chair, board members, I actually received an email indicating that she could no longer stay on the call.
Okay.
Dr. Glessinger, you should be on the call too. I confirmed with her.
Okay. Is Dr. Glessinger on the phone? Okay, hi. All right, so Dr. Mahani, your report, please.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen of the board. This is a complaint number 2206-C against Dr. Glessinger. My name is Dr. Farahani. The date was back in 9/6/2022. Here's a summary of the allegations. JP states receiving a bill for a total of $40 due to after a visit from Dr. Glessinger's office. JP states in the complaint several statements listed below. Dr. Glessinger urged the patient several times to leave the appointment before even getting started because of questions regarding billing. Dr. Glessinger treated with hostility, made the patient feel highly unwelcome, and left her hearing several times during the visit that the patient should leave because there was nothing she could do for me. Dr. Glessinger refused to close the door as requested by the patient. Patient states feet are highly sensitive topic due to scarring, and she states her privacy was not respected. Patient reports being treated in an inhumane way and was being charged for it. A bill was attached to the complaint citing visit date of 3/28/2022 and new visit code of 999202. Charge amount of $125 and insurance paid $21.19 and remaining balance was $40, which was her copay. The licensee's written response to the allegations was received on behalf of Mr. Crawford for Dr. Glessinger. The board was received this letter on 19th of July of 2022. It was addressed to Ms. Broaddus. This is a response to the complaint filed against me, reported by Dr. Glessinger, by JP related to her office visit on March 28, 2022. On March 28, 2022, JP presented to the office with chief complaint of course on the second and fourth toe both feet. She said they bothered her when working out and caused pain with excessive activity. She said she had tried topical treatment to exfoliate the skin with salicylic acid. This helped lighten the discoloration, but the darkness of the area kept coming back. She was interested in what else she could do to prevent it from getting worse. Dr. Glessinger recommended she try a deeper and longer toe box shoe to avoid further irritation or additional hyperpigmentation. She did not recommend surgery at that time. Unfortunately, from the initial call when JP scheduled her appointment, Dr. Glessinger reports that her staff communicated she was rude, aggressive, because we couldn't tell her the exact amount she would be responsible for. And then approximately 2 months after being seen in the office, they received a call from her asking to waive her $40 copay. The receptionist told the patient that she would investigate it and see what she could do. JP was extremely rude and threatened to write a negative review. She threatened to let everyone know not to be seen at her office, falsely claiming that Dr. Glessinger was a racist. Before we had a chance to return her phone call or speak with our billing company to clarify her charges, she proceeded to call another 20 times. JP then posted two slanderous reviews claiming I was a racist and acted dismissively to her. Again, at the time of she scheduled her appointment, she asked the receptionist what the charges would be for her visit. The receptionist explained, since we are in network with her insurers, we would not know exact amounts, but that she would be responsible for a copay required by her insurers. At the time of her appointment, prior to being seen, she asked the medical assistant what the charges would be. The medical assistant let me know JP still wanted to discuss this with me prior to her visit. I walked in the treatment room and let her know we typically do a standard office visit depending on the complexity of the case. She would be charged copay, but beyond that, she could not guarantee what other amounts she would be responsible for. That was solely dependent on the insurance. The allegations that were followed, JP initially complained about the bill for $40 due after her visit, which was the copay required by insurance. She further alleges I urged her to leave this meet several times because of her questions regarding billing. Dr. Glessinger shares that this was completely false. She tried best to explain how they typically charge a standard visit. And any money owed by her would be dictated by the insurance. Number two, she alleges I told her I could not help her, and there was nothing I could recommend. Dr. Glessinger reports she explained her condition and did not feel surgery was indicated for her problem. She discussed shoe gear change and recommended a deeper or longer toe box shoe to avoid additional irritation or slash hyperpigmentation as a result. She alleges I treated her with hostility and made her feel feel unwelcomed. Dr. Glessinger shares that she treats all patients with respect and dignity. She attempted to hear her complaint and respond with appropriate treatment recommendation, as she does with all her patients. She alleges that Dr. Glessinger refused to close the door as she requested for discretion. She shares, I do not recall her asking to close the door. I typically have a medical assistant in the room when treating patients as a standard practice, and I should I need an assistant. She further states at the end of her letter that there is no basis for JP's complaint on her false and defamatory remarks. To be honest, I'm deeply offended by JP's false accusations. I respectfully request her complaint to be dismissed. I reviewed the medical records on 3/28/2022. JP was seen for a cold on 2 and 4 toes, both feet. Those are digits. Discussed shoe gear and recommended deeper and longer toe box to avoid irritation and likely subsequent hyperpigmentation to the area. Surgery was not recommended. The diagnosis code was N2041, which stands for hammer toe, right and left. And then 9922 visit code was billed as a new patient. Patient did sign new patient paperwork and agreed with their fees, copayment, deductible, insurance disclaimer signed by the patient on 3/28/2022. There were some reviews that were left by the patient claiming that the doctor and staff were racist. Review number one was left by Kupanda Skincare. If you're black, stay away. The staff can't communicate with the insurance company to find out fees associated with office visit. And then the review number two, she'd rather pay court fees than pay the outstanding bill to prove a point. You don't get to mistreat me and then get me to pay you for it. There was a letter affidavit signed by the office staff. I have the letters attached to my investigation report for the board to see. There was a call log that was handwritten. And most importantly, there was a Cigna letter dated to 5/25/2022. The letter read, customer concern letter provided by to Dr. Glessinger stating no further action was required. The customer was required to render copay for services for received by the specialist. Just for redundancy purposes, I'm not going to go over the complaint interview because we listed that as the summary of allegation. The financials, a bill was attached to the complaint citing visit date 3/28/2022. There was a new visit CPT code of 99202, charge amount of $125. The insurance did pay $21.19, and the remaining balance was $40, which was the patient's copay. Here's my conclusion of the findings. I do not believe that the allegations from the complaint are really substantiated. I believe that the patient signed the doctor's office paperwork with respect to fees, copays, and deductibles, otherwise known as the disclaimers. Patient willingly signed for the documentation. In addition to the CPT code, I firmly believe that the 99202 visit code was an appropriate code and was in sync. However, some may suggest that the 99203 is more of an appropriate code for a new patient visit. I certainly think so. In any event, if they followed those recommendations by billing experts, the doctor actually underbilled for the services that was provided. Of course, that's solely my opinion as a practicing physician would I. Lastly, patients should have an understanding that doctors are not billing experts. Therefore, patients should always do their due diligence to pertaining to the fees, etc. This matter appears to be a matter of copay fee, which patient is responsible for, and the Cigna letter correctly states as such. The last one, which makes me very sad, is the respect to the reviews. It saddens me to see a patient labeling someone as racist on a public social platform. I think there's got to be a better way that such remarks should be regulated and censored. by these platforms, as it could be defamatory and damaging to one's reputation and livelihood. And I know almost all physicians have been subject to those. And so I find these allegations unsubstantiated, and I sign on 9-6-2022. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Farahani, for that very complete report. I have no questions. I think you laid everything out on the line that was pertinent. So this is just one of those cases where I feel bad for the doctor having to deal with this. Woman, Dr. Ilana, you have any questions? Dr. Glessinger, would you like to make a remark? Mr. Crawford, make the remarks.
Yeah, if I could, just a couple, Dr. Campbell. First off, Dr. Glessinger is in Tucson, so we didn't feel for this that it was appropriate to have her drive all the way up, but it's not, she takes it seriously. So we just have a patient that unfortunately doctors have to deal with in this day and age that was very aggressive, even from the initial phone call to make an appointment, when you can't tell them exactly what they're going to have to pay because it's dependent on their insurance company. Mm-hmm. Nobody can give that kind of assurance to people. And then it just, you know, progressed from there. The doctor felt that the appropriate treatment was to do shoe modifications, was not a surgical procedure. That's not dismissing the patient. That's giving the patient your best professional recommendation. And then we really deteriorate. I've known Dr. Glessinger for a while. She's a very well thought of provider in Tucson. There's absolutely no history whatsoever of her or anybody in her office making racist comments to people or treating people differently based on race. It's unfounded. She didn't really know what to do in terms of those posts, and I said, respond to them. You know, it's inappropriate. And so, you know, any doctor out there can be the recipient of this type of accusation when it's completely unfounded. I think, unfortunately, you just have to go back to, was the treatment appropriate? Were the recommendations appropriate? And they clearly were. So it's unfortunate that we've come to this point in medicine where we get these kind of unfounded allegations, and not much the doctor can do other than say it's just completely not true.
Well, I like to be a can you repeat, Dr. Glessinger?
I couldn't even hear who that was.
Because the complainant went on, I was informed it was not going to be on, couldn't hold on to the call, so she was off.
If that is JP, this is Heather Broaddus. I did receive an email indicating that you could not stay on the line. Is that you on the line? It's very difficult.
To be able to offer context, because the previous speaker, that was just very dismissive. And while you may know Dr. Glessinger, I do want to say that in this day and age, we have seen people who have been very well known and have really great careers. This is Jemaine Peace who made the complaint.
This is not appropriate because you were not present when we started the case, because we were told you were not going to be on the line, and we were hearing from the doctor's counsel, and we were just wrapping this up.
I understand that, but I also want to share that I was not aware that it would be over an hour until I would be heard.
This is a professional board meeting, ma'am, and we have lots of things on our agenda, and that's part of coming to board meetings. We go through
the agenda of the meeting, is what I was saying to you. It's not that it was unprofessional, it's that I simply was not made aware. That's what I was saying. I don't want to be dismissed. Continue to be dismissed, because from the sounds of what I just heard, you know, this was a lot. you know, and I don't want to do that.
When we are completed, then I can allow you to make a short statement. So we just need to, well, I will ask you at the time when it's appropriate. Mr. Crawford, I just wanted to make a comment that I thought her response was very professional. The response on the post, that Dr. Glessinger's response was quite professional and like non-explosive. It was a good response.
Thank you.
Dr. Glessinger, do you want to make any remarks?
Sure, I just have a quick statement. I just wanted to say that the patient was aggressive and rude from the first call because we couldn't guarantee how much money she was going to be responsible for. She wasn't happy when she came in. I proceeded to listen to her concerns and I made recommendations, but I did not feel surgery was indicated. She then proceeded to make defamatory comments and leaked about my office that were definitely false. Honestly, I'm very offended by these accusations. That's it.
Thank you. All right. Now, JP, I can give you a couple, 2 minutes to give us a statement. Thank you.
So I first want to first offer an apology because I was very frustrated with the fact that when I called, it wasn't very clear about cost. And so I do want to apologize for that because I am personally held liable for the medical bill, and I wanted to try and prevent that. However, when I got to the office, Dr. Glessinger, you had offered me to leave the office twice before the appointment even started, before you even introduced yourself.
Ma'am,
I offered to leave.
Ma'am,
I'm simply giving my testimony.
I know you're giving your word, but pardon me just a second. You're not talking to Dr. Glessinger. You are just making a statement. Thank you.
When I entered the office at the time that my appointment started, Dr. Glessinger, and I hope this is okay to say without any other interruption, but Dr. Glessinger entered the office and before introducing herself offered for me to leave because she made it clear, look, I can't give you any clarity on fees. If that's a problem, you can leave. Then she stated, you know, that that she was a bit uncomfortable. I also remember that as well. So there were several offers to leave the office before the treatment even started twice before. Then I asked to close the door. She declined that. She declined me some privacy. My feet are a very sensitive issue, and I simply wanted privacy. That was declined as well. An associate of hers came in during the appointment. Didn't ask if that was okay or anything like that. I was a little uncomfortable with that because I do prefer privacy when I enter the doctor's office. Also, there weren't any concrete recommendations given. She briefly gave a statement, but just so that you all are aware, I had to visit several other foot doctors to actually get some clarity, to get some time to have a conversation. And also, being rude on an initial call does not give a doctor permission to say that when you come in, I'm going to be rude and dismissive to you. You can simply decline my appointment. But I was not helped. I was not given any specific ingredients, products, nothing that I could do to actually manage the discoloration on my feet. So that is not me being served correctly, and my insurance was still billed even though I didn't receive help. And you all on this call are saying that that's okay to do because you know the doctor and you have history with her. That's a bigger part of the issue here, that just because a few people may know of that person, may have a good resume or whatever, that means that if someone comes in and has a complaint, that they're just simply going to be dismissed and disregarded.
Okay,
so,
ma'am,
I just want to be clear. I was not provided the assistance that I requested. I was denied privacy, and I was also treated very rudely upon entering the office because of that initial phone call. And if that's okay with you guys, then
we have thank you for your comments. I will tell you, back to the issue of insurance. There are so many insurance policies. When people come in, a doctor contracts with the insurance. They do not know how
how much of what they charge has to be written off. You had a copay. You paid the copay. The insurance company indicated that you were responsible for that. We do not regulate office staff. We regulate the doctor here at the board. There have been no violations of any of our state statutes. You know, not everybody does well with every physician. That's why we have other, you know, you can...
Ma'am, this case is... And you should be respectful to me, too. You all have
I am being respectful.
You're denying the response of Dr. Blessinger and her staff to be dismissed as part of me. The issue was not that it was not about the interest. It was about the way I was treated, not provided assistance during the session, and then I was billed for not receiving the treatment. That is not okay. And if you are okay with that, that is a problem.
JP, this is Heather Bratis. I can give you a call after the meeting if you would like to do so, but the board is getting ready to make a motion.
Second, any discussion? All in favor? Aye. Opposed? So moved.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, God. Right, let's take a 5-minute break. It's 10:06. Thank you, everyone, for your patience.
I was losing it. I knew.
Huh? No, that wouldn't happen that way. Okay, back on at 10:14 a.m. All right, our next is Dr. Paul Shapiro, 22-14-C. Mr. Scott King is counsel. I'm present with Dr. Shapiro, so gentlemen. And then we have, I apologize. Mr. King is not present, but his... Yes, where are we? Yes.
Leah Shacker.
Yeah, where are you, Leah? There you are. I'm sorry. Yes.
Not a problem. Thank you.
And Dr. Polkoff is our investigator, so Dr. Polkoff will please give her report, and we do not have, complainant is not present. Okay. So, Dr. Polkoff.
Thank you. Good morning.
That has been present for over 40 years, which helps cool the area that the doctor is working on to make the area less painful for the patient. In this rare case, the patient had a freezer burn from the ethyl chloride and reported a complaint for the burn. In review of Dr. Shapiro's records and the records of the physicians that the patient followed up with, there is report of the chemical irritation. But in review, I found no violation of state statutes, and I do believe that Dr. Shapiro handled this appropriately. My conclusion was unsubstantiated for a chemical burn sustained by patient SL. Thank you, Dr. Polakoff. I have no questions. Do you have, Dr. Pullman? Dr. Ilano, do you have any questions for Dr. Polakoff? All right. So, Dr. Shapiro, would you like to make a short statement or your counsel?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, board members, and thank you, Dr. Polakoff. Leah Shacker on behalf of Dr. Shapiro. Just briefly, when the patient presented to Dr. Shapiro, she was referred from her primary care physician who had indicated she was not satisfied with her prior podiatrist that she had seen. Dr. Shapiro did look at her medical history, determined there were no contraindications to treatment, he used the ethyl chloride spray, as he's done, consistent with his routine custom and practice for the past 35 years. The patient SL did not complain of pain after the biopsies. There were no signs and symptoms of cold injury on that date. He advised her of proper diabetic foot care and follow-up in 2 weeks. Had there been any reaction, Dr. Shapiro certainly would have documented that reaction, even as evidenced by his letter back to the referring provider. There were no complications. He would have certainly noted that when he provided her the referral back to, or the letter back to the referring provider. 4 days later, she called complaining of issues. Dr. Shapiro saw her promptly and made the diagnosis and provided her with appropriate follow-up treatment. And that treatment was synonymous with the treatment that was provided by the two subsequent treating providers as well. They had, by and large, the same diagnosis and the same recommendations for treatment. She was not seen after, I believe, July 28th, so we're not aware of what her current status is. Dr. Shapiro's office ultimately ceased contact when she asked to stop being contacted by his office. We just ask that, based on the fact that Dr. Shapiro met the standard of care in his treatment and there were no violations of the podiatry board statutes, that the case be dismissed.
I just have a question, Dr. Shapiro. How many times in 35 years have you seen a reaction to ethyl chloride?
Once.
So I will make a motion. Dr. Ulano, anybody else? Do you gentlemen have anything? Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and make a motion to dismiss case 22-14-C for Dr. Paul Shapiro, as there are no violations of state statute.
Seconded.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So moved.
Thank you.
Nice to see you. Not under this circumstance.
Great holiday.
You too. Enjoy. All right. Now, let me take Dr. Bangard's case, because that's quicker. The next case that we're going to hear is 21-24-B, which is Dr. Keith Bangard. Dr. Polakoff is the investigator. Mr. Moscow is Dr. Bangard's counsel, who is present, and I believe Dr. Bangard, is he on the line?
I am.
Thank you. All right. So, Dr. Polakoff.
Good morning, Board. Case number 2124B, Keith Bangard. This was a board open case due to a malpractice case that was reported. The doctor was voluntarily removed from the malpractice case, but an issue did come up with this review. In the review, the doctor did see a patient who terminated Dr. Bangard's care and transferred to Dr. Jared Lieber. Dr. Lieber did see the patient when Dr. Keith Bangard became aware of a board complaint against another physician in his building and office. He did call Dr. Jared Lieber and ask if Dr. Lieber could write a letter for him explaining the status of the patient that would help him with the complaint to the podiatry board. Dr. Lieber did write a letter stating that he saw the patient on August 6th, presenting with vague left foot pain. She commented on her displeasure with the outcome of a previous foot surgery. He mentioned that he could send her for an MRI to further evaluate soft tissue pathology that may account for her current foot pain. In calling Dr. Lieber advised me that he was contacted by Dr. Keith Bangard to write the letter. I did ask him if the patient gave him permission to discuss the patient's case with Dr. Bangard, and he said no. I did call the patient and ask if she gave permission to Dr. Keith Bangard to discuss her care with Dr. Lieber. She said no, she was unaware of it. I do find that I'm going to substantiate a HIPAA violation with Dr. Keith Bagart in contacting Dr. Lieber to get a letter to help him out of the state board case.
And on this case also, Dr. Bagart was voluntarily dismissed with prejudice from the original malpractice.
That is correct.
Yes, and I will make a motion at this time to go into executive session for the purpose of receiving legal advice.
Second.
Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. I'll be back.
And for those individuals on the phone, if you could just remain on the line, and if for some reason you're disconnected, you could just call back in a few minutes. Thank you.
Seen the board go into executive session before the conclusion.
Back in session, actually, now it's 10:31 a.m. We have heard Dr. Polakoff's report, and as I stated before, that Dr. Bagart was voluntarily removed from the malpractice case. So I'm going to go ahead and first make a motion on that so that we can discuss the other question that is at hand. So I will make a motion to dismiss the complaint of 21-24-B as it relates to the malpractice case that was documented in Dr. Bagart's license renewal application.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. All right. Now, the topic that we're going to have some discussion here on is in regards to what's appearing to be a very, well, I need to hear from Dr. Bagart first. I'm sorry, Dr. Bagart. If you would like to make a comment, please, at this time, or if you would prefer your counsel to make remarks, we'll do so at this time.
Well, first of all, good morning to the board. It's an honor to appear before you. I'll make some comments, and then if Dr. Bagart would like to add anything or answer your questions, obviously that would be fine. To begin, thank you for recognizing that Dr. Bagart was voluntarily dismissed from that lawsuit, from SW's lawsuit. I think it was a mistake on the part of his insurance company to have reported that to the National Practitioner Database. They're only supposed to report settlements or verdicts, and obviously he wasn't a part of the settlement. So I appreciate you taking your own motion and handling that. As far as the alleged HIPAA violation, Dr. Polakoff unfortunately is mistaking Dr. Keith Bagart for perhaps another Bagart. SW's complaint that came about, I think, around the same time as her lawsuit, or after she filed her lawsuit, but before she served it, the board complaint was against Keith Bagart's father, Daniel Bagart, as you'll all recall. That complaint was 2 years ago. I received Dr. Polakoff's investigative report from that case in November of 2020. And that investigative report addresses Dr. Lieber's letter in there, although it doesn't make any allegations of HIPAA violations. And what's known from that complaint and the issues that went into that complaint is that there's no mention of Keith Bagart there. Keith Bagart, in fact, never spoke to Jared Lieber about SW's complaint or the lawsuit from SW or any other matter. And in fact, as Dr. Keith Bagart will tell you, and forgive me, I keep saying Dr. Keith Bagart, his whole name, because there's quite a few Bagarts that I know you're all familiar with. But Dr. Keith Bagart never called Jared Lieber. In fact, while Jared Lieber happens to be lifelong friends with Dr. Keith Bangart's much younger brother, Dr. Keith Bagart doesn't know him well at all. And as Dr. Keith Bagart will tell you, he hasn't seen or spoken to Dr. Jared Lieber since Dr. Jared Lieber was not a doctor, but was in fact a 12 or 14-year-old kid hanging out in the Bagart home when Dr. Keith Bagart was visiting from college. So the complaint, and I think Dr. Polakoff may have referred to SW's complaint being against Keith Bagart. It wasn't. It was against Daniel.
and there was no HIPAA violation because Dr. Keith Banger never called Jared Lieber. And one, I have two questions I'd like to ask, and I would, or at least some information I would like to get from Dr. Polakoff, which I'll address to the board properly. Which one is, what provision of HIPAA is supposedly violated here? Because there's none cited, and HIPAA is, as you all know, being medical professionals, is a rather large federal act, and it covers a great many things. And I'd be willing to bet that everybody in this room is well aware of how HIPAA applies to a doctor while practicing their area of medicine. But this isn't that. This has to do with a board complaint, which is, so there's nothing stated as to what provision was violated. Board hearings, including all the discussion of Dr. Jared Lieber's letter, which we had 2 years ago, is available to anybody in the public, downloadable by the recording. It's not necessarily protected health information. Number one, so I'm unaware what provision would have been violated anyway. It wasn't cited and it wasn't explained, and there's a ton of exceptions to every provision in HIPAA, or most provisions. Number two, I'm curious if Dr. Polakoff, in her investigation, the one she conducted 2 years ago, or the one she conducted recently, involves her actually speaking to Dr. Jared Lieber. I believe she spoke to him 2 years ago. And she documents that Dr. Lieber reportedly told her that Dr. Daniel Bangart's son had called him. But he wasn't referring to Keith Bangart. Keith Bangart has a brother, as I said. I don't know if his brother called him. I don't know if Daniel Bangart called him. But if you want to see information on that, it's addressed in a two-year-old response, not to the complaint, but to the investigative report that Dr. Daniel Bangart provided. But in sum, I could tell you Keith Bangart never spoke to Jared Bangart about SW or any other patient. And I suspect that, and if I'd be more than happy if you could do it, and I don't know if you could, to get Dr. Jared Lieber on the phone and just ask him flat out who he spoke to, because it wasn't Keith Bangart. And this and the last thing I'll say is this is an unfortunate, and with all due respect to Dr. Polakoff, who's obviously very sweet and very nice and pleasant and has been very pleasant to me this whole time, but with all due respect, I think it was a very sloppy investigation. And I think it was, and at the very least, it mistook Dr. Keith Bangart for someone else. And forgive me if I sound frustrated. I am, on behalf of my client, because he was dragged into a lawsuit that he had no business being involved in. And I know every one of you understands how unsettling that can be. And now he's been dragged into a board hearing for something he had nothing to do with. And if Dr. Keith Bangart would like to add to that, I mean, he's welcome to say what he would like, or if you have questions for him, feel free to ask.
So, Dr. Bangart, do you have any remarks?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
So, Jerry, appreciate you listening to me. My concern is kind of what Mr. Moscow alluded to, is the fact that Dr. Polakoff never called me, never spoke to me. I've never been contacted by the board other than by the initial complaint. And so, had she done so, I could have said, and I have not spoken with Jared Lieber since he was a teenage boy in my family's home. My brother's 9 years younger than me. I have never spoken to him in all this time. You know, I'm older, I've moved on in life, and so I don't know where this, you know, if she just assumed that I'm the son that Dr. Lieber was referring to in that letter, then I don't know what to say. I feel like, you know, everything was just fabricated, and now I've been, you know, wasted the money being down here because of the simple fact that she just refused to call and actually do a true investigation. So I'm frustrated by that, and the fact that, you know, that all this didn't need to happen, had this been handled appropriately.
I think this HIPAA stuff is, you know, it's such a gray area of things, and since now we've heard from Dr. Keith Bangart that, you know, and as far as the way things work on, you actually have to have a conviction on a HIPAA violation. There's none of that, and there was nothing that was given in a civil court situation. So that's something else that, you know, as point of information or new knowledge to understand it, how these things work. So I think, you know, everybody should learn, we can all learn that better communication improves a lot of stuff. So
I make a motion to dismiss the 21 no violations of violations.
Thank you. Second. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
I can't hear. Sorry, this is Dr. Brown. I couldn't hear anything that you guys just mentioned. It cut out.
Oh, the motion was for Dr. Smith.
Your mic might have gone out.
The motion was for dismissal.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Which is approved.
Okay. All right. Our next case is, where's my number? Where'd I go? It's Dr. Christopher. Where did I put my... Okay, next case.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you. Yeah.
Well, it's a pleasure to see you all. I would suggest, I hope I don't have to come back just on behalf of my clients. On my own behalf, I'm always happy to be here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Complaint 22-08-C is Dr. Christopher Funk, and again, Dr. Polakoff is the investigator on that case, and Wilkin. Hi. Counsel for
it is still
Dr.
morning.
Yes, sir, it is. All right, so we'll go ahead and start with Dr. Polakoff's report here. So the only person left on the phone should be Dr. Alano, correct? As we have no complaint, correct?
I'm here.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Board. This is case 2208C, Christopher Funk, DPM, and the patient is GW. GW made a complaint against the patient regarding concerns to his foot post-operative condition. He states that he told Dr. Funk several times that he has an autoimmune disorder on prednisone and that he takes longer to heal. In spite of these words, the doctor proceeded to remove the sutures. At 12 days, the incision split open, considerable pain for the patient reported. The patient went to another doctor who had to perform surgery to debride the affected bone and tissue. The patient did go on to a partial ray amputation from this surgery. The allegation, negligent care for removing the sutures early despite the protest from the patient or the record of the prednisone use and extremely thin skin, substantiated. The doctor made a note in his records describing his skin as very thin. He was on oral steroids, years of RA treatment, and medication use. Sutures were removed at 12 days post-op as predicted. The wound opened immediately. When the patient was seen by the doctor, he put in three sutures to try to close the gap. With a history of long-term steroid use for arthritis, reports of skin pre-op being very thin, by removing the sutures early at 12 days post-op, the wound opened, bone exposed, leading to a very prolonged post-op period and the partial amputation. In review of the records, I have several concerns. I do not see a consent form, so I am assuming that the consent form for surgery was performed at the hospital and that there was no copy in the chart. The patient was seen initially on 9/30/21 and 10/19/21 for a wound to the third toe. On 10/19/21, the patient requested a cortisone injection. The doctor refused due to fragile nature of the skin and put a prescription for Mobic. 2 months later, on 12/7/21, the patient presented with a new concern of a fifth met head. The site is red and sore. Current episode started more than 1 year ago, and the problem occurs daily. gradually worsen. The symptoms are aggravated by standing and walking from pressure. He requested cortisone to the 5th Met Versa injection, which was preceded with 1% lidocaine and 0.5% marcaine plain with Ketalog 20 milligrams and dexamethasone 2 milligrams. My concerns at that visit were what conservative care was performed, even though it is written, and I do understand that current episode started more than a year ago for irritation to the 5th Met, but I don't see any documentation of any off-weight bearing inserts, devices, orthotics, post-op shoes, cam walkers, anything to off-weight load the area. A cortisone injection was given, but the patient has a past history of gout, very thin skin, and just 2 months ago it was listed that there were concerns about a cortisone injection. Just 2 weeks, slightly less than 2 weeks later, the recurring problem of the ulcer, 5th Met head, was seen in the office, aggravated by walking or standing, according to the doctor. Previous injection helpful for only a few days. There was a slight opening, but no drainage. It was advised not to wear bike shoes. The records need improvement. If there's a slight opening, I don't see any measurements. Was it 1 millimeter, 2 millimeters, 10? How long was it? Where was it located? I just see the 5th Met head. Was it dorsal, plantar, lateral? I have no idea. And also, if a patient of mine has an ulcer of the Met head and it's aggravated and it was seen 2 weeks after it was red and sore, I don't see an x-ray. I don't see any evidence of radiographic findings, which were definitely needed. On 1/4/22, an appointment was made for x-ray. There's a sharp bone spur consistent with a Taylor's bunion on the 5th Met head right. There was bone-to-bone arthritic changes noted in the 5th Met head. When we originally subpoenaed the records, I did request all records. I reviewed the records and noted that there were no x-rays. X-rays, an x-ray visit of 1/16 was sent, but I had no other x-rays at all. But on 1/4 it says an x-ray, but I have no knowledge of those x-rays. On 1/16, I did review the x-rays, and the x-rays show sclerosis, calcification, small and medium arteries, which is consistent with Mockenberg sclerosis. Mockenberg is progressive stiffening of the elastic layer of the arterial wall. It manifests by the appearance of the arterial-type ulcers on the skin of the upper and lower extremities. Since I have no idea where this ulcer is, and I see the calcification on x-rays, I don't want to rule out that diagnosis. The workup on this is poor. There's no lab reports. There's no biochemical report to show that he's excessively putting pressure on the lateral fifth. There is little conservative care noted that I would love to follow up in the record. And on 1/17/22, he had an office visit the day after the x-rays, and it was noted a Taylor's bunion, wound right foot, acute gout right great toe, wound getting worse. He went to the ER on the 16th. They performed the punch biopsy. X-rays were taken. Rx for antibiotics. Patient states wound is getting worse, swollen, red, and painful. In this note, I would have added what antibiotic he's taken. I would have either taken a picture or done measurements on the wound. 1 month ago, the symptoms gradually worsening. For a very fast advancing ulcer, more information is needed in the chart. The doctor ordered an MRI to rule out osteomyelitis and x-rays for pre-op. He's ordering x-rays for pre-op, but what conservative off-weight-bearing treatment has been performed? I don't see any documentation. On 1/19/22, the pathology or the lab results showed no acid-fast bacteria isolated 6 weeks, which is good. The op report pathology showed the 5th Met head with viable trabecular bone and attached fibrous tissue, negative for acute osteo, negative for Gram stains. The operative report shows that it was an excision of the 5th metatarsal head, right foot, closure of deep capsule tissue with 3 ovicral, and the skin closure in layers of 4 ovicral and 4 onyla. first post-op visit was on 1/31/22. Post-op pain, swollen redness. The incision site shows intact sutures, lateral right foot. There is some wound dehiscence in the area of the excised ulcer, lateral fifth met head. No drainage. There is minimal erythema noted, and there is pain to my patient. The fifth toe is in alignment, palpable pulses. The skin is thin and frail. The patient tolerated the suture removal, and this was 12 days post-op. There is still healing incision with a lack of complete resolution, which is expected given his prednisone use and poor healing capacity. The labs from the bone sample are not available, but given the nature of the excised metatarsal head, I recommend another round of oral antibiotics. The patient agreed and was given dressings. The medical records state that sutures were applied to assist in healing on February 7th. This was confirmed by the following treating physician. The patient was allowed to get the foot wet following the 12/20/21 visit. If there is drainage and wound dehiscence, it was the doctor's choice to say he can get the wound wet, but according to the patient, he said after he got the wound wet, it opened up further. On 1/4, there was an appointment for x-rays. Sharp bone spur consistent with the tater's bunion, but I do not have those x-rays, and I only have the x-rays again from 1/16. I don't have the x-rays from 9/23 either. It goes on with pain, swelling, and the healing of the incision is still slow, which did not get resolved. The patient eventually switched to another physician who documented that the x-rays were in place, the sutures were in place, and he applied a Stravix allograft to the right fifth metatarsal. Eventually, surgery was performed, amputation, and the patient is still healing from everything. The second doctor did prescribe orthotics immediately to off-way load the area and a rollabout to take weight bearing away. In conclusion, I find that the medical records are lacking and need improvement to describe for the following physician what, where, and how. And I do believe that the doctor should have done more work, lab work pre-op, lab work post-op. And the patient was on oral steroids for a long period of time. Was he a diabetic? Did he have arterial problems causing the visible arterial calcifications present on the one x-ray that I could see? Many questions are present. I found that the allegation was substantiated.
Thank you, Dr. Pollock. Dr. Foreman, do you have any questions?
No, I think
Dr. Ilano?
No questions for Dr. Polakoff.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Polakoff. All right. So, Dr. Funk and Mr. Whittaker?
Yes, ma'am. So, the complaint was filed, I believe, in July. It was undated. The only allegation was that the sutures were removed too soon, 12 days post-op. Mm-hmm. On January 31st, the surgery was done on January 19th. Dr. Funk responded to that, then got Dr. Polakoff's report for the September 29 letter. The report was September 4, I believe.
Yes.
The only issue that was raised in the investigation report, which Dr. Polakoff deemed to be substantiated, was that the sutures were removed too early. Dr. Funk submitted his October 19, 2022 response to that. This is the first time I've heard any concerns from anybody about consent forms, Mecklenburg sclerosis and x-rays, poor documentation, lab reports, biomechanical reports, advancing ulcer. These are all new issues that were not raised in the complaint. They weren't raised in the investigator's report. We haven't had any opportunity to address them because they haven't been raised. So Dr. Funk is here to address the issue of the suture removal, as he did in his response to the investigator's report. The rest of this is all news to me. Further, I don't have any of these records. What I do have, it was submitted in September, is a demand letter from the patient asking for $86,000 plus, allegedly due to infection because of early suture removal. I'll ask Dr. Funk to address that, but that doesn't appear to be the case. It wasn't infection at the last time that Dr. Funk saw this patient on February 7, but what we do know is on February 7, he secured first wound care treatment at the clinic, but the patient was unwilling or unable to do that. So Dr. Funk then secured home wound care. The patient allowed two visits from the home wound care people and then refused any additional treatment. According to the demand letter he sent, again, the last time he saw Dr. Funk was February 7, when the home wound care was obtained. Then the patient says on February 8th, he sent a picture of his wound or his foot to this Dr. Hook, whose records, although they're referred to in the patient's complaint, we've never seen. But what we do know is, according to the complaint, the patient says on February 8th, the day after the last visit with Dr. Funk, contacted Dr. Ernest Hook in Folsom, California, apparently a prior treater for him. He looked at a picture of my wound and told me I needed IV antibiotics, wound care, and it was very serious. There was a chance of losing my foot! Dr. Funk had already secured the home wound care, which again, the patient only allowed two visits, and then the patient apparently did visit Dr. Funk over a month later. Okay, so what went on in terms of Dr. Hook? Apparently, there's been an amputation. We've never heard of that. It's not referred to even in the investigator's report. So my understanding is, yeah, the patient, again, Dr. Funk will address why he removed the sutures when he did. The patient came back a week later on February 7. Here's the care for that was appropriate, including the home wound care, and the patient was on antibiotics. The patient did not follow up with Dr. Funk, and I don't know what happened after that. But again, the only allegation that we're aware of was the early suture removal, according to Dr. Polakoff. And so I'll turn it over to Dr. Funk to address that issue. But of course, whatever questions the board has would be welcome.
Mr. Whittaker, I'd like to ask, so what did you receive as far as materials?
We received the complaint. Okay, I have Dr. Then we received the investigator's report. The complaint says, I see attached notes from Dr. Hook, but they're not attached to what we received.
Well, if they hadn't had the whole,
this is, and Madam Chair, board members, and I had several conversations with Dr. Funk's, I believe, medical assistant or office manager. The entire complaint was sent to Dr. Funk on a flash drive, and this is part of the delay of the complaint because initially it was the office manager did not realize that there was a flash drive in the envelope. So after that conversation, she did realize that all of the materials that I received were there. I was never asked to subpoena records from Dr. Hook. I did not. I don't have them.
And with all due respect, because Heather's always very responsive and reaches out appropriately, I really wasn't concerned about Dr. Hook so much because the allegation was early suture removal. Mm-hmm. The patient did come back a week later. There was some dehiscence, which was appropriately treated. So whatever follow-up he had with Dr. Hook was not particularly relevant to us responding to the question of early suture removal. But now, apparently, it is because we're hearing about all sorts of other things, including amputation or something.
Yeah, well, and that's... When we get a complaint, and yes, you zone it, you know, the major allegation, but that doesn't say that the investigator can't find other issues in, you know, in a case. So did you even have x-rays? Physical? You didn't see physical x-rays?
No, he has three images of x-rays that were taken in January.
Right, and that's what we have in our, and that's what we have in our thing.
No, we don't have the other ones.
Because there were two dates that was 9/23 of 21 and 1/16 of 22 from an ER visit. So those were two films we never had.
Nor do we. We don't have that.
Because those would be, I believe, they're important because the issue of the Mockingbird sclerosis, it's very apparent here in the film.
Yeah, we haven't seen those, and that's the first reference I've ever heard.
I think we should continue this case. We need to, you know, get those.
Dr. Hook.
Well, yeah, from Dr. Hook. Those need to be received, subpoenaed and received, because, you know, we can't do our due diligence, and you have to have what you know, we all have to have the same information, because that's not prudent.
No, in fact, we are prepared, and we have addressed, and we're open to any questions about the only issue that was raised. And apparently I don't know what Dr. Polakoff has since September when she did her report, but the report, which I always look at very carefully, has one allegation which she deemed to be substantiated, and it only dealt with the suture removal.
Mockingbird sclerosis, yeah.
I've never heard of it, yeah. Although I've been doing that for 35 years, but certainly not in the context of this case.
Right. And I know with the primary issue of the wound incidents, but what we see on the x-ray certainly affects that discussion.
I'm beginning to understand that.
Yeah.
Would
you
like to make a motion to remand it back?
Yes, I will do that.
To add the violations discussed today. Potential violations,
yeah. Okay, so I will make a motion to...
Can I say one thing?
Oh, I'm so sorry, Dr. Funk. I apologize. That's rude of me. I'm sorry.
Well, just in regards to the x-ray, the very first visit he came in, he had x-rays from another facility, another doctor that he brought on the desk. So I don't have those in my office. I don't have access to those. And those were looked at. So I don't have that first set of x-rays you're wondering about. The only x-rays that I have, you have now. So that's all I have.
That's all. So the ER didn't send you anything. Okay, so that's who
send me
a report?
A report. It was all secondhand from the patient.
And I don't know, for instance, I would assume if that's something that's evident from an x-ray, the radiologist presumably...
Well, see, exactly. And this is a problem.
Oh, by the way, Dr. Funk did come up from Tucson today.
So. I know. I appreciate that. We appreciate that. But this is how we have discussions, because seeing everybody face to face and talking about this is important.
Mark, did you take the x-rays or you sent the x-rays out?
The ones you have, I took.
Okay.
Yeah, I have those. And those are the only sets of x-rays I have.
Okay.
Okay.
And, you know, and it's pretty obvious. Oh, I'm sorry. I won't speak out of turn. But it's a pretty prominent bone. And anyway, I don't know if you want to table all this, or I'd like to try to get resolution on this because of this. I'm taking time out of my practice to be here, which I know this is important. I'm not taking away from that, but I would like to try to get this figured out.
Sure, I understand. So I'm going to go ahead. I'll take. Yeah, you can.
I know. I wanted to be here. This is important to me.
We have
come before the board before. This is my first time, and there's been a lot of fireworks already this morning. And welcome to Tucson. Anyway, so I just wanted. This is important to me. It's my reputation. I've been in practice over 20 years. I've never had anything brought up to the board before. So, I just wanted to give my side of the story. So
that's what we did. Okay. Thank you. We appreciate it, truly. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and make a motion to amend this case. 22-08-C back to investigation to retrieve x-ray reports and x-rays dated, should be 9/23/21. That's what the patient had brought in as per Dr. Funk. That may not be elegant, but the ones from 1/16/22 at the ER, also adding in possible violations of state statute would be 854.01 would be number 22, which is committing a conduct or a practice that might be harmful or dangerous to the health of the patient. And that was including the topics that we talked about biomechanics and the wound care and medical evaluation.
Yeah, it's just so she knows what.
Just so you know what, yeah, okay. Okay, so that's the motion.
Second.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. So, do you gentlemen have, Mr. Whittakin, do you have any questions or if you...
Well, I wasn't able to take notes on everything that Dr. Polakoff raised today, but I'm assuming we're going to get some investigation report so I know what questions to ask about what additional records we need and what these actual allegations are, other than the ones we were prepared to address today.
So we're all on the same page?
Apparently.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. You too.
Sam, drive safely, please. Too many crazy people out there. Yes. Yes. 1105. 1106. We'll take a bike here.
Dr. Yolanda, so we're going to take about a 5-minute break, so we'll be right back, okay? Okay, thank you.
Case. And we have to call the council on that? Oh, no, this isn't a case. We're moving, number six. This is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding a self-report from Dr. Thoresh Yadupa.
And Madam Chair, Board members, I'm actually going to email the attorney for Dr. Yadupa right now, so if maybe we can move to some other items.
I will do. Okay, so while Heather is calling, let's go back to number four, which is our general session meeting minutes from September the 14th, 2022. I don't see any issues. Does anybody have any additions or corrections for said minutes? All right, I'll make a motion to accept our general session board meeting minutes of September 14, 2022, as there are no additions or corrections.
Seconded.
Second. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. All right. Let's see here. Okay, we can start on license issuances. We have five here. Our first, move on the second, let me get to that part of the screen. There they go. Up there they are. Okay, so our first we have here is Avery Garner. This is a regular podiatry license. Every fees have been paid. Residency was completed in June. Everything's in line. Does anyone have questions or concerns on that application?
No.
Alrighty. So seeing that the application, I'll make a motion that seeing that the application meets state shoots, it's complete application for a regular initial licensure and the initial registration to dispense drugs and devices from Dr. Avery Garner and to issue the license upon payment of the issuance fee.
Seconded.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Next license application is Dr. Terrence Hess. This is also a via regular podiatry license application. Fees are paid. Everything, all the requirements have been met. Does anyone have questions or concerns? Hearing none, I would make a motion to accept this complete application for regular licensure from Dr. Terrence Hess, and to, this includes the initial registration for dispensing drugs and devices, and to issue this license upon payment of the issuance fee.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Next is Melissa Hahn. This is a licensure application via comedy, currently practicing in Washington, Oregon. All requirements have been met. the fee paid. Does anyone have any questions or concerns? Hearing none, I will make a motion to accept this application via comity as it is complete in borrowing state statute. And this includes the registration for dispensing drugs and devices as well, and to issue the license upon payment of the issuance fee.
Second.
Okay, any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. The next applicant is Dr. Gerald Merritt. This is an application via just regular license with the initial dispensing registration. Fees are paid. Everything is in good shape here. Anybody have any questions or concerns? Hearing none, I'll make a motion to accept this complete application for initial licensure and initial dispensing application to Dr. Gerald Merritt, and to issue this license upon payment of the fee.
Second.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. Next applicant is Dr. David Wander. This is application via comity, practicing since 85 and indicated such in the letter. He actually won't practice here in the state. He just needs his licensure for the kind of work he does. So everything is complete and meets statute. So I'll make a motion to accept the initial licensure via comity with initial registration to dispense drugs and devices, and to issue the license upon payment of the issuance fee.
Seconded.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved.
Thank you.
Now, are we ready there, Heather?
For the participants on the phone, this is Heather Bratis. Did Ms. Lisa Bivens join the call? I do not believe that she is
not present. Is Dr. Yadupa on the phone?
Is Dr. Yadupa present? Madam Chair, Board Members, I did email Lisa Bivens, the attorney for Dr. Yadupa. I asked her to join in about 5 minutes.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if there's another item that we can move to.
Sure.
To give her some time.
You want to go to number 7, because that shouldn't, or 7, number 8, that shouldn't be too long, about the update from the October 28, 22 Federation of Podiatric Medical Boards
Yes,
meeting.
Madam Chair, Board Members, thank you. So I attended the October 28, 2022 meeting that the FPMB held, and the meeting was focused on just a roundtable discussion between different jurisdictions. There were 5 topics of discussion: podiatric medical assistant regulation, board certification versus licensure, scope of practice, and in-person CME requirements versus online study. There was also just very brief discussion about rules. So the most interesting thing that I learned was that there are some jurisdictions, New York I believe is one of them, California is one of them, where the actual board itself requires that a podiatrist be board certified in the specialty area in order to perform ankle surgery, which means that the board is taking responsibility for that instead of leaving it up to a hospital to determine
who credential
perform surgery, ankle surgery. So that was very interesting. And the scope of practice, I did ask other jurisdictions if they allow their podiatrists to supervise hyperbaric oxygen therapy. And some jurisdictions have issued a statement indicating that they do feel that that is within a podiatrist's scope of practice. I also asked whether or not other jurisdictions allow their podiatrists to administer nitrous oxide, and no other jurisdictions feel that that is within a podiatrist's scope of practice at this time.
So those were the key takeaways I got. There was quite a bit of discussion about podiatric medical assistance. I talked about our, you know, state's issues that we've had with that, and California had some similar issues. They're still working through some, just as we are. And the FPMB is planning on holding these meetings, I believe, quarterly, just for a roundtable discussion between jurisdictions. So if there's any issues that you would like me to bring, you could just let me know, and I can ask other jurisdictions. So it was a good meeting.
I think the next one's, I want to say the 27th of January, for some reason that sticks in my head, since I didn't get to be president at this one. So, yeah. Did anybody have anything on x-rays, Heather? Did anybody discuss anything?
For podiatric medical
assistance? Yeah,
yes, that was a very large part of the conversation, and I went through, you know, Arizona's issues that we've had with and now we're going through the rulemaking process, and now we're going to be put in Department of Health Services exemptions on that. And so I went through that entire process. California was the only other jurisdiction that spoke up in which they've had issues. The only issue that they currently still have, and I hope that I'm portraying this correctly, is that there are some facilities in which podiatric medical assistants are employed, but because there isn't a supervising podiatrist, they can't take x-rays, is what I understand. That's the only issue that they have. They've been able to resolve other, you know, podiatric medical assistants who are in a podiatrist's medical office can take x-rays.
Any response yet, Hilary?
No, those were the key takeaways I got. But I can answer any other questions if you have any.
So what do you think would be, Seamus, will your report take too long?
I actually don't have anything to say.
Okay, so that was bid number 7, the updates, the legislative update.
If we're just trying to give Dr. Yupita's attorney time.
If there's any specific questions, but you know, we'll just kind of wait for legislation to play out through any issues we may have.
We can discuss it.
I see that a lot of it this year was less to do with the board and stuff. It didn't have to do with the board.
And Madam Chair, board members, if I may, the only legislation that effectively directed our statutes was that the good moral character
removed.
That was for all boards. Yeah. That was taking out of all board statutes.
So we can have anybody. Yes.
Last year, far Democrats and Republicans voted to say.
All right, so number 9, Heather, your executive report.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, board members. The board may recall that on May 17th, 2022, Dr. Chad Westphal entered into a non-disciplinary order for continuing education in resolution of complaint number 22-15-C. On November 7th, Dr. Westphal submitted his continuing education, and in consultation with the board chair, it was determined that he has met the requirements of that non-disciplinary order, and he's released from the order. I also have an update on the transition to the new website. I do have a go-live date now. It's January 25th is the anticipated go-live date. And because Salesforce will not prorate the fee, if the board chooses to have a database for those 3 weeks in calendar year 2023, then the board is required to pay for a full 12 months. So I've opted, and I can do otherwise if the board so wishes, but just to go without a database for those 3 weeks. That does not mean that a licensee or an applicant will not have access to the board's website. They can still pull applications, change of address forms, things like that. It's just mostly my input into the database. I'll have to just track that on my own. And because January is a little bit slower for the board.
Please put a notice on the website for that. This is
I can.
Yeah, so it's
yes.
A lot of money. So.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I will definitely put a notice on the website that there's a transition. And most licensees, well, I shouldn't say most, but especially during renewals, I talked to a lot of licensees, and I've made them aware that we're transitioning to a new system.
I was on that the other day looking and hoping.
I also attached the 2023 board meeting calendar. If there's any discrepancies, just let me know as quickly as you can so I can...
I've checked for Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah. They don't collide with our schedule.
I provided the current budget. So far, everything looks good on that for FY23. And... the board members that are present have the most current complaint log. I haven't added any new complaints, though, since I sent board materials. So that's my summary, and I can answer any questions.
Thank you, Heather. All right, so any summary of current events, number 10? Call to the public. There's no public left to call. Anybody have anything they'd like to see under 12, under any future agenda items, any discussions that you'd like to have or items? Hearing none.
Madam Chair, board members.
Yes.
For future agenda items, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Just to give the boards a heads up, I have been in contact with Mr. Abadi, and the board is aware that the association will be running legislation to put podiatric medical assistance in the exemption for the Department of Health Services statutes. I do plan on bringing that draft language to the board at its December meeting.
Okay.
And Mr. Abadi, the lobbyist for the association, is aware of that. So I should have that for you.
Who's the sponsor? Do they have a sponsor?
We don't know we don't know who's chair of the
committee.
Yeah, the health committee yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We're hoping it will be PACE.
Yeah.
We're just not sure.
Okay. And number 13, as we have our next board meeting, is the 14th of December, 2022. Now, we have to, would you like to start the, can we start the meeting earlier, do 8 o'clock?
I would like that.
Okay.
So we're going to do the meeting at 8 o'clock on December?
No. Okay. Do we have to make a motion on that, or we can just do our own thing? Okay, so yeah, that way, and then hopefully then Dr. Wano, everybody will be here, because it just makes it so much easier. I mean, in that way, yeah, traffic, that 15 minutes can make a difference, and when you leave your home, and especially coming on the 51, holy. Now, so since we have this item left here that, and we haven't had any luck getting the council on the line, do we just just table it till next month? What do you think?
I believe that
we can give an administrative report on it.
Well, I just wanted to jump in real quick. It appears that there was a violation for failure to notify the board. So if the board wanted to, the board could dispose of that part of it with a letter of concern for failure to notify. And then what you can do with the rest is take no action and administratively close the complaint until such time as a disposition is made on the tax issues.
Okay. All right.
And if I could just clarify with Shannon, with the board, if they were to issue a letter of concern, would they have to simultaneously open a complaint? Or can they do it
without opening a complaint.
Yes, you would want to open a complaint and then immediately issue a letter of concern only for the village.
Right. Okay. So everybody is aware, obviously read the packet, and they know that this is case number, we don't have a case number yet. So Dr. Udupa, we received information, and it's currently under investigation. But he did not report this on within the statutory time of 10 days to self-report. And he has signed and attested to the fact that he has read and is familiar with state statutes on license applications and license renewals, so that excuse cannot be used that I did not know. So I will make a motion on this to open a board complaint against Dr. Udupa for failure to self-report, which is statute
854.01.
No, it's not a
3230.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Pardon.
Failure to report.
So failure to, 32-32, correct?
32-32.
08, which is failure to report, self-report a conviction or a charge. So do I have a second?
Second.
Oh, pardon me. Let me amend. No, can you retrieve your second? Retract your second. And that offer a letter of issue a letter of concern regarding same matter.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. And I will then, as regarding the other item of this issue, to administratively close.
I would say to take no action.
Okay.
Until such time.
And then, okay. So I make a motion to hold the case, or what's the word I want to say? Not table it.
Table it, because technically what we're doing. That issue.
So we will,
Take no action.
At this, So the motion will be, so at this time we will, in regards to Dr. Udupa, that we will take no action on that remaining portion of the issue until the legal action has been completed.
Second. This is Lisa Bivens. I just joined from Dr. Udupa. I'm so sorry about the timing. I did not see Ms. Broadus' email. Can you bring me up to speed on what the first part was? I heard the tape notes part.
Absolutely. Ms.
Bivens,
this is... this is Assistant Attorney General Seamus Monahan. So the board is voting to issue a letter of concern specifically just for the failure to report. And then as far as the rest of the allegations or matters, the board is going to take no action and will open a case if and when it needs to in the future after the disposition.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
So can we ask her for information or no? We didn't move out. Ms. Bivens, this is Dr. Campbell Burcher. Do you mind, can you kind of give us a little updated information from what was already previously sent to us, where things are in the legal schedule?
Yes, absolutely. So substantively, we've learned that the nature of the allegations arise from allegedly fictitious W-2s that were issued from Dr. Yusufa's own company, Maricopa Podiatry Corporation, between 2009 and 2016. He no longer works with that company. He's in a group practice now. The W-2s are not at all related to patient billing or money collected in his practice. The allegations are related to whether or not he was entitled to a tax refund for those years or not. So it's IRS concerns whether his W-2s were filled out correctly. My understanding is that Dr. Yusufa used a CPA for these years exclusively, and obviously we're still trying to get our arms around the allegation and the defenses. In terms of the procedural updates, the state did make its first disclosure and disclosed something like 10,000 documents with more to come. So there's a lot of documents, and we're in the process of hiring a forensic accountant and trying to track down the CPA that Dr. Yusufa used. Both the state and Dr. Yusufa's criminal counsel have recently moved the court to set this for a complex case designation because of the complexity of the documents and the discovery that's going to need to occur. And we expect that to be granted, which means that we're looking at protracted litigation here. The first pretrial conference is not scheduled until the 28th of this month, but with that motion pending, that's likely to get bumped back.
Thank you so much. We appreciate that heads up. And then we ask that if you receive any updates that you'll forward those to our executive director here at the board.
Absolutely. If anything changes, I will absolutely stay in touch. Right now, we're just kind of trying to get the lay of the land.
Yes, it sounds like it.
And just to be clear, there is not a board case that will stay open regarding this matter. If and when, okay, if the board decides later after the disposition that they feel they need to take some kind of action, then they would decide at that time to open a new case. So there will not be a case pending during the process.
Appreciate the explanation. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks so much. Appreciate that you could get in back to us here. Thank you.
Sorry about the timing. I appreciate you guys hearing me at the tail end here.
Okay. All righty. Okay. Any other order, anything else that anybody wanted to add or that we, okay. Well, seeing that all agenda items have been gone through and adjudicated, I will offer a motion to adjourn at 11:37 a.m.
Seconded.
Thank you. Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So moved.